This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So if you were only doing the small stuff and totally ignoring the big stuff, then you're not making much of a dent. And that's really where the information is power. And if we understand where the biggest source of emissions are coming from in our own daily choices, then we know where we can make the biggest change.
Are you the kind of person who calculates your carbon footprint the way some folks count calories? And if you aren't, should you be? This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel, and her colleagues from the Union of Concerned Scientists have written a guide that makes it easier to reduce your carbon footprint by 20% without sweating the small stuff. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel. She is a co-author of a new book called Cooler Smarter, Practical Steps for Low Carbon Living. She's a staff member at the Union of Concerned Scientists, which is a science-based nonprofit. Brenda, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Union of Concerned Scientists and the motivation for this publication?
Absolutely. We are a nonprofit that is looking for solutions that have science, the best available science for issues such as climate change, clean energy, cleaner vehicles, our food and environment and global security, as well as scientific integrity. And what we really are focusing on with this book is showing people how after we crunched the numbers in 500 consumer categories, we looked at everything from going to the doctor to renovating your home to the car you drive. And what we found is that there's a lot of confusion out there. And sometimes we've been told to do certain things, which we found based on the numbers that we may be sweating the small stuff too much. We really shouldn't worry about that. And we should focus more on sweating the right stuff.
There's a great pie chart in the first chapter, or maybe the second chapter, where the average American's carbon emissions come from. Why don't you break that down for our listeners?
The three areas that matter most are how you get around, the energy you use in your home, and what you eat. The last big bin is the stuff we buy. And for example, when we look at all the habits of Americans, we really are in our cars a lot, even looking at international travel by planes and so on. That's really surprising in that it means that we can go a long way towards reducing our carbon footprint in this area because we do have cars that can now get 40 miles per gallon. And a lot of us are driving cars that are 20 miles per gallon. And if you did that upgrade, I mean, sometimes people change their cars for a new or used car about every 5 years. And when you're at that decision point, you think about the miles per gallon. Recently in March, I upgraded old vehicles that were getting 20 miles per gallon and traded them in. They were 20 years old and 14 years old. I was hanging on to them. They worked just fine. But after working on this book, I realized, what am I doing? That's so much worse. I traded it in for a used car that was 4 years old that gets 40 miles per gallon on average. And on the highway, it gets even better miles per gallon. What I see is that if I drove the amount of miles that the average American does, and 12,000 miles is what most drive, and over 15 years, I would save and put money in my pocket that I wouldn't be paying at the pump at today's gas prices, around $18,000.
And that's with gas at $4 a gallon, right? Somebody making that calculation today is probably not taking the looming specter of $8 to $10 a gallon into account, I would imagine.
Exactly. I mean, this is probably, given the demand for gas around the world, we can only expect that probably gas prices would go up over those 15 years.
And then later on, you break down the transportation piece in another pie chart where it says from that 28% of your emissions, for the average American, car use accounts for more than one quarter of total carbon dioxide emissions. You have a little explanation on how can a car's emissions weigh more than the gasoline that went into the tank? I thought that was pretty interesting. Can you expand on that?
Right. What's very interesting is it's hard for us to realize that just the use of a device that there might have been carbon emissions in mining the ore or the metal and the manufacturing, but in fact using the car, and it's pretty inefficient when you come right down to it, that it's much worse to put that gasoline in your tank and burn it than it is just the production of that gasoline.
When you were talking about buying a four-year-old car, I've heard that your carbon footprint can get offset by the actual carbon that gets used for production of a new vehicle. Did you put that into your calculation when you were buying a car?
The calculations that we did for this research, we calculated all the emissions that are the manufacturer of, say, a new appliance, a new refrigerator, a new car, anything that had a carbon emissions associated with it, all the way, you know, well-to-wheels analysis, as well as the fuel, you know, how much does it take to, what are the carbon emissions associated with producing that fuel before you put it into your car and things like that. And so when you put that all up and add it all up, we found over and over and over again this theme that the use of a device over and over and over again, when you have more efficient options out there, it's much worse to hang on to it because you are worried about the carbon footprint of the production of the very device. For example, refrigerators. If you have a model that's older than 2003, there have been standards put in place for energy efficiency for refrigerators that if you bought a new model today, you would recoup the cost of that refrigerator just between the difference in energy use of your old refrigerator, older than 2003, and this new one in a couple years. And then after that, that's the gift that keeps on giving. You save that money on your energy bill each year.
One of the problems, though, is that a third of Americans are renting, and there's not as much incentive for landlords to overhaul their renters' devices and appliances that might come with the house, like a stove or refrigerator, if it's not going to be saving the landlord money.
Absolutely. And I did this when I was renting an apartment. I asked my landlord, I said, hey, you know, I don't like this thermostat where I have to change it all the time whenever I want to change what my thermostat is. And I would forget to turn it off when I leave. And I asked if it was okay if I could go to the hardware store and buy one of those, you know, for $20, $25, you can get the bottom of the line programmable thermostat. And that makes a huge difference because I was paying for the electricity. And whoever rents that apartment after me has that benefit. One thing we did find in the book is we saw some studies where they did polls of Americans who do have programmable thermostats, and we found that most of them don't take time to program it. So you really don't want to heat or cool your home when you're not there.
I'm a fairly well-educated person. There's no way I could figure out how to program my thermostat. So,
well, then ask a friend to come over and
help
out.
No, I just either turn it off or keep it really low.
And that really does save energy to change that programmable thermostat. Another thing is to really, if you can ask your landlord, hey, I want to have an energy audit. I want to see where I can plug up the leaks and so on. And you could do that for if you own your home as well. And there's a lot of programs that give money for sealing up those leaks. Most people, looking at a lot of the studies that have been done, are losing about 15 to 25% of the energy costs through leaks in their home. And if you plug them up, you could, if you paid $1,100 a year to heat and cool your home, you could waste as much as $275 annually. And that's something that is equivalent to having a window open year round, a 15 to 25% leak rate.
And you have a chapter called Sweat the Right Stuff, and made me think that maybe it's who should be sweating that stuff. So for example, my landlord is very eager to upgrade our toilets to save a few dollars on their water bill, which is great. You know, more efficient toilets, less water use. We're in a crisis point in water and you don't want to be wasting water. But in terms of carbon emissions and the actual savings, something like a refrigerator, which is 15 years old, being changed out would probably be saving a lot more for the environment than a newer toilet, right?
Absolutely. And it saves a lot of the energy costs. So it is very, very important to upgrade to the newer standard appliances when you are at that point where you can replace your appliance.
Well, great. I will either have you call my landlord or I'll just send her this segment from Sea Change Radio to her.
Don't put a price on my soul. My burden is heavy, my dreams are beyond control. When that steamboat whistles.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel. She is one of the authors of a great new book called Cooler Smarter, Practical Steps for Low Carbon Living. Getting back to transportation, there's some things that you break down where like you hit stuff you buy and food, but those are really part and parcel with transportation in a lot of ways in terms of where the carbon intensity comes from, right?
Mm-hmm. For example, food in the grocery store, we looked at all the imports and exports of food in the United States, and we found out that for the items in the grocery store, only about 4% of the emissions are from transporting that food to your grocery store. Most of the emissions are what happens on the farm, especially with a lot of the red meat. And so if you want to do community-supported agriculture, it makes sense for fruits and vegetables locally because they are such a low carbon footprint. And so as a percentage of their travel local does make more of a difference than if it came from very far away. But in general, a pound of meat is equivalent to 18 pounds of pasta regarding heat trapping emissions that warm our planet.
And does that include local meat?
Yep. Well, when you think about, for example, beef, especially if it's grain-fed beef, and think about how many months that animal is eating grain from other farms that are being using fossil fuels, tractors, you name it, on those farms, and then you transport that grain to the feedlot where you have, or to the place where you're feeding the beef, and then finally it comes to your table. That's a lot of emissions. Whereas the transport of that final beef to your grocery store is a very tiny fraction of red meat. And so if you love red meat, as I do, I like to make it a treat. And other people might choose to, well, I want to have it all the time, but maybe instead of being the center of your meal and being the bulk of the calories, maybe moving it to the side and filling up the calories with fruits and vegetables, which is, and directly from grain, which is probably something that would make your doctor happy too, because it's a healthier balance. And for example, a family of four, the average per capita consumption of red meat in this country is 270 pounds. If a family of four were to cut their consumption in half, that would scale up to be equivalent to not driving an average car for half a year.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel. Brenda, you spoke about grain-fed beef, and a lot of us look for grass-fed beef now, which is much more widely available in supermarkets because we think it's healthier to eat and tastier, but it also is lower carbon, according to what you just explained in terms of the grain transportation.
Absolutely. I prefer to make it a treat, and I buy grass-fed beef myself. And make it a rare part of my diet. And what I see is that, for example, if you knew that your red meat came from a local farm or a farm halfway across the country, because the food miles don't matter as much. But that farmer perhaps had access to electric-powered farm equipment that was powered by renewable energy, and they were capturing all the methane from their operations and generating locally produced energy, then that would be perhaps a much better source of the meat, for example. And if it's grass-fed and you're not feeding it the grain that is grown on other farms that might be fossil fuel-driven. Another aspect is, for example, vast in California, you're next to lots of areas of land in Nevada and ranch land that really, if you were to use that semi-arid land for growing other types of food, it may be more sustainable to have, you know, cattle that are grazing far and wide but eating local vegetation and creating, you know, using calories that for land that wouldn't otherwise be used for growing other types of food because it's so semi-arid.
People are trying to find more and more of these kind of silver bullet solutions. What did you find in your research in terms of myths?
Yeah, for example, a myth is, should I read an e-book or should I read a paperback or a, you know, a hardcover book? It's really not going to matter. When you think about it, that's really sweating the small stuff. The differences between those two is very tiny. And maybe perhaps if you were to hop in your car and drive to the store to get the hardcover, you know, it might be a little different. I mean, it basically, don't sweat it. Buy whichever form of book you like to read. Those are some of the myths. For example, there's advice to maybe not ride the elevator. Maybe do it for exercise, but you don't have to have the carbon footprint be the reason that you're doing that. It's a different choice.
That makes sense, and that's probably what a lot of people would like to hear who like to take the elevator. But then you hear somebody can come up with a statistic saying, if we all stopped using the elevator 30% of the time, that would feed a third world nation for a whole year. Like, there's all these ways to calculate how if we all just did one thing, but it never seems to work that way. So that's one of the frustrating things with trying to change societal behaviors, like making families across the country eat half the red meat that they do. Isn't that it's a pretty Sisyphean task in a lot of ways.
Well, you're touching upon exactly how that scaling it up really matters, in that, and really what we're asking is that to people to take a 20% chunk out of their carbon emissions, no matter how you do it, as long as it's 20%. And so for some people, the meat story might not be the way they want to do it, but other people, they might want to make sure that they are reducing emissions through other ways that are easier for them. Certain things they just cannot change, and other things they can change easily, and it doesn't matter which way. So if everyone were to reduce their emissions by 20%, those who live in the United States this year, that would be equivalent to not needing the electricity from a third of our dirty coal-fired power plants. That's 200 out of 600 coal-fired power plants that we have in the United States.
And why 20%? Where does this number come from? I'm sure it's not just random.
We picked this number in part because we looked at how the United States per capita emissions are the highest in the world. We're about four times greater than the world average. We're also double the average of countries like Japan and France that have a similar standard of living as us. So that means we have a lot of low-hanging fruit. And 20% this year is manageable with stuff that's already available, that's available at our fingertips that we can, if we're intentional about it. So that's why it's 20%. And we say, if you've already done your 20%, then share your stories with your friends and your neighbors and people at work and where you gather to work and play, because some people just might be inspired, like you are, to save money. A lot of these are cost savings event steps, and also just some of the benefits. I stopped commuting to work using fossil fuel transportation, and I commute to work by bike, and my doctor's happier about that.
What about moving to the city? In terms of carbon intensity, there's a lot more services available to people who are living closer to these services and other people like yourself, where you can bike to work.
Right. It is a personal choice which way, but there are a lot of other options for folks. Like, for example, it's much harder in my community where I live to encourage them to perhaps get some solar panels on our, you know, we have all combined units and a roof system that would be great for that, or trying to have perhaps some solar heating or any wind options in my urban setting. Whereas folks who are living out in a rural setting might have many more options like that. And that's pretty exciting. So it really, we all have different options depending on what our circumstances are.
And getting back to some of the small stuff that you don't think is worth sweating, what about something like organic cotton? Would that be in that category of the small stuff, or is this something that you think your readers should put in their arsenal of ways to try to reach that 20%?
Well, I have to say that since I've reached my 20%, I'm looking for more of those things that are smaller to start shaving even more in my personal carbon emissions, overloading the atmosphere. And so I'm looking for some of those savings wherever they are. In other words, if you were only doing the small stuff and totally ignoring the big stuff, then you're not making much of a dent. And that's really where the information is power. And if we understand where the biggest source of emissions are coming from in our own daily choices, then we know where we can make the biggest change. So you can either add up a whole lot of this little stuff that's pretty small, or you could go after some of the big ones. For example, by upgrading a car from, if you drive 12,000 miles a year, if you upgrade from a 20 mile per gallon car to a 40 mile per gallon car, you would be about 17% of the way towards your 20% this year. And that would be not an option for everyone because it's a big change. And you might not be at that point. You might have just bought a used or new car last year or 2 years ago. So then you look at some of these other options.
I've had choices since the day I was born. There were voices, they told me right from wrong. If I'd only listened, I wouldn't be here today, living and dying with the choices I made.
Sea Change Radio is sponsored by Redwood Hill Farm, a family-owned and operated award-winning humane certified goat dairy farm and organic creamery located in Sonoma County, California. Go to redwoodhill.com to learn more about Redwood Hill Farm's extensive line of natural goat milk dairy products. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel. She's the co-author of Cooler, Smarter: Practical Steps for Low Carbon Living. To start this process, the lowest hanging fruit is your transportation needs and your habits. Is that right? Is that how you started to make a significant stride towards 20%, Brenda?
Well, my first steps were, I thought purchasing a car was a big step, so I had to start saving for many years. So my first step was I replaced all the windows in my apartment building, and that made a big change. I upgraded my appliances. I decided to live closer to work, so I eliminated the car for my weekly commute, and I made those changes. And so those to me were something that were how I was starting, and I think everyone has their different entry points to starting to reduce emissions depending on the choices that are available to them. But one other thing is, for example, some people are holding on to incandescent light bulbs and waiting until they burn out. One thing is that if you had a home with all incandescent light bulbs, you'd have to turn off your light bulbs 4 days out of the week just to get the same savings if you had your lights on with fully replacing every single outlet with an energy, more energy efficient light bulb that's available today.
What about vampire power? What are some of the steps that people can take to try to eliminate the electricity that seeps out of their homes when they're sleeping?
That's right. It's really, I would love for standards to be put in place for all the little devices and all the, I don't need 10 clocks in my kitchen telling me what time it is, but I wouldn't mind when I need to know if something is on or I'm charging it, that I could push a little button and have that little green light show on and said, yes, it's charging, or the power strip, yes, it's on, but then it goes off after 15 seconds or something. You don't have to look at the clock unless you're pushing the button to see it, and or an indicator on your recorder for your favorite shows on television or something like that. So what we do is, for now, we can stop all that phantom or vampire power from, for example, your television could use just as much electricity, even though you've turned it off. So what I do is I have an extra power strip that I have easily accessible. You have to see it, and you could turn off the power strip for the devices that you don't need to have on when you're not watching the television or some other device. And so you just turn that off instead of the remote control off button. And there's a lot of electronic devices that are that way.
And you have some great resources at the back of this book in the appendix, which is some terrific carbon calculators, some websites for green power purchasing. Why don't you give us a quick overview of some of your favorites?
Sure. One first stop shopping is, if you wanted to take the 20% challenge, I would suggest going to coolersmarter.org, and you could put in your personal situation and it will pull examples from the book of where you can start making a change and try to take a 20% chunk out of your own emissions. So for carbon calculators, one of the good ones is it's called coolclimate.berkeley.edu. So it's right there in California. It's a great resource. If you're in the market for a hybrid car, there's a www.hybridcenter.org, and it stacks up all the different hybrids. And some of them are what we call faux hybrids, that they advertise as being hybrids, but they don't really give you the miles per gallon savings that you're expecting. So that's a great resource for that.
We were talking about some of the myths. One of the ones that I had heard before, and I remember you hit upon it in your book, is when you're driving, is it more fuel efficient to just use the AC or open the windows? Because there's wind drag associated with opening those windows. What did you find?
Don't sweat the difference. Whichever you prefer. If you want to feel that wind in your hair, open the windows. If you want the air conditioning, turn it on. Because exactly what you said, there is drag when you have the windows. And of course, there's more energy when you have the AC. But when you do the calculations, it's pretty much a wash. Either are both acceptable. they really don't. One's not worse than the other.
I would qualify that by guessing that this is freeway driving only. If you're driving in the city at low speeds, I'm imagining that keeping the air conditioning on would be more carbon intense.
Certainly, you don't have as much drag when you don't have the higher speeds.
Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel, co-author of Cooler, Smarter, Practical Steps for Low Carbon Living. Thanks so much for coming on to See Change Radio.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to See Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Ike Turner, Bob Dylan, and Betty Levette.
See Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to See Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For See Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.